Welcome to the Romanticy Library.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Romanticy Library. I'm your host, Kate Perkins, and today I have a really fun and interesting interview with internationally best-selling author A.K. Mulford. I was so excited about this interview, I forgot to do an intro. So here we are. We're doing it right now as we speak. So without further ado, here is A.K. Mulford.
So A.K., let's start from the beginning and talk about, like, where are you from? You know, born, raised, life growing up. You're not Australian.
No, I'm not. I mean, technically, I'm both American and a Kiwi. But I grew up in the U.S. In Connecticut, East Coast. And I went to high school and university in Massachusetts and Boston.
Okay, I'm so sorry to interrupt you. Where did you go to school in Boston?
BU.
Okay, I went to Northeastern. Yeah, I went to Northeastern for a semester.
And oh, cool.
One of my best friends went to Simmons.
Oh, nice. I was debating between Simmons and BU.
Oh, my gosh. What year were you there in Boston?
Oh, gosh. 2006 to 2010.
So we were there. I was there in 2004. I was a freshman. So she was – but she was there at the same time that you were. We're colliding anyway. So she's also a writer. Yeah. That's so wild. I think because when I was there in Boston, I think the stat was something like 300,000 other students were there too. So whatever. But yeah. Boston's a very cool city. Okay. Anyway. Yeah. So you were at BU.
Yep. So I went to BU, and while I was at BU, I was studying classics and biology. So I was double majoring in two very different majors. But I had planned on going into wildlife biology. So in between each year, I was going to first the UK to study and then South Africa, and then eventually moved to South Africa to work with baboon rehabilitation. And then from there, got a job in Guatemala, where I was working with wildlife there. And from there, I met my partner, who's a Kiwi. And so we moved to New Zealand. And then we lived there for like 13 years and, you know, had kids there. And I became a citizen. And then it's only in the last couple of years that we've moved over here to Australia to get some more sunshine and also some more like access to autism support for my kids. And just so there's a little bit more going on, it's a little bit easier, I think, to run an author business from Australia too. So but we love it here. We love all the sunshine.
That's an amazing story. I was wondering how you got to Australia.
Yeah.
So you met your partner.
Around.
No, I'm a big jumper rounder too. Jumper rounder?
Yep. And
I do have my outline, so hopefully we'll stick to it, but we probably won't. Anyway.
No worries.
So you met your partner.
I'm very happy to go down rabbit holes.
I'm here with you. But you met your partner in South Africa. Is that what you said?
In Guatemala. Cool.
Yeah. Guatemala. Okay, I'm sorry.
And so actually my first rom-com, She's a Keeper, is basically the story of how we met. Yep. All the embarrassing stories in that book are true.
can you share a little bit about how you guys met then?
Yeah. Well, so our meet cute, our actual meet cute is in the book, and it is, I was cleaning a monkey drain hole and I just, our little like fishing net wasn't working and there was a clogged drain. It was the end of the day and I was just so ready to go have a shower and be done for the day that I decided I would just roll up my sleeve and like stick my arm like shoulder deep into this drainage hole to unplug this like wad of monkey poo. And as I was doing it, I heard someone like clear their throat. And I look up and our head vet is giving a tour to this very handsome Kiwi man. And I'm just trying to like hide my poo covered arm. Be like, oh, hi, how are you? You know, just very awkwardly. So we like to say it was love at first sight. And And then we lived in the jungle together for a long while. So I think you really get to know a person when you don't have, like, you know, hot water and electronics, and, you know, you really know if you're compatible or not.
Wow. Yeah, that would be quite the bonding experience. Well,
definitely. I mean, we kind of met when we were both so exhausted and kind of, like, you know, very, like, tired every day and kind of grumpy when, you know, I got dengue fever and we were sick and, like, you know, so he saw all the, like, hardest bits of me right away. So when we, like, moved to New Zealand, it was like another honeymoon phase for us, I think, because we were like, look at this, we can just go to the grocery store and we can, you know, we were living our best lives for sure. Gosh. He likes to joke he was playing the long game with my author career taking off, you know, because there's not a lot of money in conservation jobs, you know. I had always been a writer, and I was always, like, telling stories and writing in notebooks filled with stories, even as a kid. And especially living in quite remote places for my job, you know, they'd have, like, a take a book, leave a book shelf, but you'd read through all those books pretty quickly. And then, so I'd write my own stories because I wanted something to entertain myself with. So even living in the jungle, I was writing stories, but I just thought, you know, there's no way I could put these out in the world. Like, it would be too hard. I couldn't do it as a career. And then it wasn't until the pandemic, when I was at home with these two little kids, that I, like, thought, you know, why not? Why not do something with this? And so, a lot of people were making sourdough or, like, needing some creative outlet, you know, to create something nice and do something to occupy their time. And I decided, you know, I'm going to self-publish my first book. And then I did. And so, it's been an adventure ever since.
Yeah, that takes a lot of courage. I mean, the vulnerability to put your work out there takes a lot of strength. So when you were in Guatemala and you were exchanging these books, did you ever exchange one of your stories? Did you ever leave one of your stories on the
show? I don't think I ever gave, like, a notebook of stories to anyone else, but I was definitely the person who was, you know, like, we're sitting around the fire at night and stuff, and I would be telling stories of, you know, things that happened in my life. And I come from a family of, you know, kind of storytellers, people who love, like, kind of telling you these, you know, crazy moments in their life. And so I feel like my first draft of my books feels like that too, where I'm like, okay, so there's this witch and she's in the mountains. And, you know, like, I'm telling my friend the story. And then this, like, really hot boyfriend shows up and he's like, you need to come with me. And, you know, and so
I remember that scene too. And I read that, I read, if we're talking about, right, the High Mountain Court, are we talking about that?
Yeah.
One? Yeah. With Remy. I remember that scene too, when they were in the bar, right. And she was, like, coming out from the kitchen and she sees him, kind of, mm-hmm. Right.
Yep. You got it.
Okay. So you never left your stories, but you were always the kind of person that, like, around, like, campfires, mm-hmm. you were the person telling stories.
Yeah.
And
yeah, I was always writing. I think that, you know, I didn't know I was neurodivergent at the time. I wasn't diagnosed until my kids were, which in hindsight is, like, quite laughable now that I look back on my life. But I think I always use storytelling as a way to, like, understand the world and understand people and social dynamics, and everything felt, like, much more accessible to explain how I was feeling about the world through storytelling than through my own personal experiences. And so I was always telling stories from the youngest age, and growing up, my mom worked at this little indie bookstore. And so, you know, was always bringing home books and things, and really kind of fostered that love of reading from a very early age. And she would always tell me, you know, like, one day it's going to be your books on the shelf and things like that. And I was like, no, you know, I'm going to be a biologist. There's no way I could do that. So
that's so awesome. I mean, you got to love, like, our family members supporting, like, that support.
She knew before I did. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, no, that makes me want to tear up. Talk about
support. I know. Yeah, she sent me a photo of my books in that bookstore and was like, you know, I told you. Like, I told you. That's awesome.
I have goosebumps. You can't see them, but I literally have goosebumps. Aww. I love that story. That's great. Yeah. And I think I saw one of your posts on Instagram too, of like, you're like, Mom, skip these chapters or something because they were.
And she was like, I tried to warn her. But you know, I mean, she's read everything. She's read all of the arcs of, you know, working at a bookstore, of everything forever. But like, it's still, I'm just like, you don't need to read that. I should just make a censored version for her without all the spicy scenes.
But didn't you say in that post, I don't remember, was it a video? It was some type of post on your Instagram, I think.
Yeah.
That she was going to read it anyway or something.
Yeah. Yep, she always does. I know this by now. She never listens to me. And the spice definitely ramps up throughout the series, the Five Crown series. So by the Amethyst Kingdom, the last book, there's quite a few spicy scenes. And I was like, I told you, I warned you, but you know, she never listens. There you go.
Yep. The cover is so beautiful. It is so pretty. I have not read this one yet. It did come, so I need to just dive into it.
Yeah,
it just came out.
Yeah,
and I got it on Amazon, but I know that we can get it, you know, on your website, other like major retailers.
Yeah, so like pretty much, you know, wherever you're shopping, Target, some Walmarts have it. You know, like Barnes and Noble, obviously. Yeah, like online bookstores. If you have a local indie bookstore, you can always ask them to order it in. And that's a great way to support them as well as me, you know, so a good way to support your local indie bookstore.
Both places. Yeah. We have some really cute indie bookstores in the area.
Yeah.
The Pretty Cozy. That's like a little plug.
Oh.
Yeah. It's so cute. And then there's another, I think it's called Under the Covers in Kansas City. And
yeah, I always get excited when I see a new bookstore is opening up in my area. I always have to go and check it out and spend some money there because, you know, I want there to be more bookstores in the world. Yeah, there's something really beautiful and special about, like, especially having a mom who is a bookseller, like, about, like, it's a gift, I think, being able to pair someone with the perfect book, you know, and help them find something that they're going to fall in love with. And, you know, for me, so many times reading was like, you know, saved me in tough moments. And so the idea that, you know, more people are able to have those experiences and be able to have something that can kind of just take them out of a tough moment for a while or like get lost in another world for a bit is like so special and important. And I think it sometimes seems like it's just this kind of like frivolous hobby, but I think it's actually can be quite like therapeutic and healing. So yeah, love indie bookstores for sure.
Hey yo, time for an ad. My friend Bree is the proud owner of Miles on Paper. It is an online bookstore where magic and adventure come to life through the pages of indie books. At Miles on Paper, they are passionate about connecting independent authors with readers, and they do this by curating unique blind date book bundles, custom book boxes, blind date puzzles, and a remarkable collection of traditionally published books. By the way, their blind date book bundles are so much fun. I had the honor of getting one myself. I highly recommend. You can find her website at www.milesonpaper.com. Check them out.
So then your inspiration for writing, it sounds like it really began in childhood. And you just, and through the pandemic, right? Like you were like, why not? Like try to publish?
Yeah. I mean, like even when I was still working at a zoo, I was like listening to all these like publishing podcasts and writing podcasts and things just because it was like a special interest of mine. And I just, you know, I had lots of 5-year plans of what I would do if ever I self-published and, you know, like how I would go about writing and things, even though I wasn't actively doing it. And then, you know, when I had my kids and I realized that they had like their own very unique set of needs and that possibly I wasn't going to be going back to a conservation job or, you know, I might be at home for quite a long time looking after them. I thought, you know, like, I'm going to need something for me and something to kind of like keep me grounded and give myself some time to like process all of these feelings and stuff. And so I was like, well, you know, if not now, then when? I really wanted to prove to myself I could do it even with little kids. And thinking I would just put out a book and kind of shout into the void and nobody would ever read it, you know? So that it took me by surprise that it did so well, for sure.
I'm not surprised. Your writing is magnificent. I love, yeah, it's so, I was gonna say, I mean, your writing is so detailed and I feel like when I'm reading, I'm falling into the story. Like it's actually happening around me.
I kind of see the scenes like a movie and I kind of wanted people to feel like they were kind of just living in the movie as they were reading the story. And each of the courts in the book is kind of based on a country I've lived in my life. So I hope that it kind of has that real tangible feeling without being too heavy on the world building. You know, I think it's very... it's fantasy light in a way. It's more about the emotions and the characters, but still I hope that people feel like very grounded in the reality of whatever scene they're in. Yeah.
No, I definitely feel that. And that makes sense in terms of wanting to create it like from a movie lens, you know, that it feels like a scene because I feel like I'm there. Like I really do feel that way as I'm reading. It's so interesting that each court, as we're talking about the five crowns of Ocrith, right? But each court represents a country that you've been or lived in.
We've got like the high mountains are like the Southern Alps of New Zealand. And then the Western court is South Africa and the Southern court is Guatemala and the Eastern court is the UK. And the Northern court is more, like Northern New England in the winter, like where I grew up in the snow and, you know, kind of Vermont, upstate New York. Nature based, like the people who inhabit there are like fey royalty and witches and things, but the like nature side of it. And I really, one of the things I've loved about living in so many different countries is it's not just a difference of like language. Like there's so many things that are like the things they find funny are different. And the things that, you know, like the inside jokes are different and like what they value most is different. And, you know, it's so far beyond just like the textiles and the food and the smells, you know? And so I really wanted each to have like its own, like South Africa, where I was, has like a very unique smell to me. And, you know, the food tastes a certain way and like the air feels a certain way and the color palette of like the bush is like a very certain way. And so I wanted people to have that feeling when they're there without having to take like 10 pages to describe it, you know?
No, I definitely can see that.
Yeah, like the Rogue Crown, you really start to feel the Western Court vibes. Yeah. Because that's all set in the Western Court. So you can, even the cover is that kind of like burnt orange, you know, and like the kind of the red earth and the dust and the, you know, the wild animals and the trees and the, you know, spiky underbrush and like, there's like rooibos tea and, you know, like all of the things. So, yeah, I wanted to have it really have that feel to it.
I mean, even down to like the details that you put into designing the cover.
And then each of the covers is based on like the colors of that court and the witches that have power in that court as well. So,
oh my gosh, I just got goosebumps. Why did I not think about that before?
So like the High Mountain Court is red witches, so it's kind of like a red black cover, and then the second book's blue witches, so it's blue. You know, it's funny, my assistant just messaged me the other day being like, wait a second. I've just put this together.
Yeah. What? Yeah. I was going to say, I was thinking about this. I mean, I love all of their stories. I really love Rua's story. As you were talking and about how you've lived in these different countries and how these courts reflect some of that, right? Or is represented by that. The Northern Court, I feel like I could live there. It's kind of like my vibe. I was like, I really like this place.
Yeah, I definitely feel like it's the most seasonal of all the places, where when it's winter, it's really winter, like snow, ice. But then in the spring, you have this just like heaps of flowers because it's like this very short time where it's warm enough, you know? Yeah, I definitely love the nature there for sure.
So then your writing process, I'm like sticking to my outline. Okay, are you a plotter or are you a pantser?
I have recently discovered a new term called a crocheter, which I love because it's kind of like, I used to call it like writing pillar scenes, where there's like kind of pivotal moments that I know I want to happen from the very beginning. And so I write those first as kind of like the pillars that hold up the structure of the story. Mm-hmm. And then I will start to weave them together, kind of like crochet them together into the full book, and then go back and start to really like see what shapes it's making and make it into the story I want it to be. So I kind of do plot in my head a bit, in the sense that I know beginning, middle, and end, but how we get there. And then as I write it, I go, okay, well, we need another scene about this, or have we explained this enough, you know? And then it kind of starts to expand from those pillar scenes. Yeah.
Wow. That's cool. That's awesome. And that makes sense. I mean, I feel like if I were to write a book, maybe I would do it that way, you know, like make sure that I have like the pivotal scenes that are important to the core story, right, and the plot, and then kind of make sure that the other scenes are kind of weaving together. And
yeah, I think I'm quite intuitive with it, where it's like I know the beats that need to happen, and so if they're not there, I usually can feel it or sense it. But it's quite often through the writing of the book, the first draft of it, that I kind of figure out, oh, this is what the story is about. Like, this is the theme. And then I'll go back and kind of layer that in more in the edits as I go. But yeah, I think for me, if I know too much, like I could never plot every single scene in a book and then write it, because then it wouldn't be fun for me anymore. You know, I like discovering as I go these little bits and nuances and things, but I have like a rough outline of where we're headed. So I'm not just kind of like wasting 30,000 words on something that is not going to lead anywhere. So yeah, I have like a rough outline. Mm-hmm.
And then how does it work for the character development? How is it similar to the crochet like style?
Yeah.
Is it?
I mean, I kind of start off with a sense of like what their emotional wounds are and like what they're trying to overcome. Like, I don't want my characters to start off the same person as they end up. Like, there's things that they need to learn on the journey and things they need to discover about themselves. Although I do think there's like certain like core themes that most of my books have with the character arcs. Mm-hmm. And so like, I just want to make sure that that character has the opportunity to like grow and change and have those opportunities. But sometimes their like wounds will change over the telling of the story, and then I'll go back and fix them.
That's something that I love, is the emotional development mm-hmm. and growth that characters have, especially in the romantasy world. And I, reading through your series, could absolutely pick up of like, okay, like AK has done some work, you know, and whether, you know, on themselves or whatever, but it was pretty obvious to me that you've done some work, some emotional growth, but also too, in the sense of that, like these characters have these emotional wounds, and that it was it seemed like it was very thoughtful. So I really appreciate it.
I think so much of my writing is almost like things I wish I could tell my younger self as well. Mm-hmm. You know, like this idea that people who are the age of the characters that I'm writing might walk into like their university bookstore or something and pick these books off the shelf and have someone telling them, you know, like, it's okay to feel this way. It's okay to be this way. Like, I didn't have a lot of books like that when I was that age. And so for me, like having that opportunity to, you know, almost be in a way both telling my younger self, but also telling my readers, you know, like it's okay to find your own way through these things and you don't have to do, you know, play by somebody else's rules. And you can find a way to like trust people and you don't have to do everything alone. You know, like those are things that I think that a lot of young people need to hear. And sometimes it's hard to hear when it comes from like another person, but it's easy to hear when it comes in a story form, you know?
Yeah, that's really therapeutic, you know, yeah. And I really, and because I think these characters, they have their emotional wounds and, but definitely it's like their growth too. And like, relying on others and connectedness and that vulnerability to like share their story or share parts of themselves. And, you know, I was just rereading Rogue. So this story about Nilo and like noticing how Nilo comes and shares more of themselves, you know, as this, I don't want to share too much, but.
I mean, like their journey is definitely one of thinking of themselves as like very unworthy and kind of like they're just living life wrong and they're doing it wrong. And there's this kind of secret language that they don't have access to that like neurotypical people speak. And they feel very kind of othered in the world that they're living in. And, you know, they also feel like they have to kind of play life on hard mode all the time, that they shouldn't need accommodations and they shouldn't need to ask for things to be different for them. And it's through the story and through their growth that they realize actually they can make the world be the way that they want it to be. And they can ask for the things they need from the people around them. And that they don't have to just try and fit themselves into a box of somebody else's making. Yeah. So, yeah.
I think that's so beautiful. And seeing and I don't know, witnessing their journey of trusting others and that ability to ask for that and that it is okay. And
cause, yeah, I mean, and they find a partner who is really like encouraging of that too, you know. I think like having that gentle place to fall, you know, is like so important for them because they've never really had that. They've always had, you know, relationships with like an addict parent and someone who's always judging them, you know, regardless of like what they're doing. And so I think it's really the first time in their life that they start to believe that Talon really means what he says. And, you know, that it's, he's not just saying that to be nice.
Right. Well, and it's interesting because as the story progresses, Nilo's like, I feel like there are these moments where Nilo's like, well, how do I want to word this? Like presenting evidence of like, Talhan is like being consistent and like this person can be trustworthy and they are like, it's interesting. I guess what I'm trying to say is seeing maybe more of Nilo's thought processes behind that and learning that, yeah, Talhan is someone that they can trust
And they're constantly overthinking it too. They're like, but maybe, you know, and I mean, like I personally have had this many times where I'm like, well, maybe they're just being nice. Like maybe they're just trying to like, you know, like this is like lots of, I've been mistaken before in misreading the signs of someone being genuine with me or not. And so now I just assume that they aren't and they're just saying things. And, but then they keep going, but it doesn't seem like that, but I don't know, you know, and just that, I think it's so relatable to so many of us where we kind of are overanalyzing these relationships because we just really don't want to mess it up and be the fool of this, you know. And get our hearts broken. So, yeah.
Oh my gosh, you just eloquently worded all of that. And that's exactly what I was thinking about, of like Milo overthinking and being like, but what if, you know, that's, yeah, exactly. Like it was so interesting seeing Milo's thought process behind that.
It was interesting because my editor was like, it's so obvious though that he's in love with them. Like it's so obvious that Telhan's just like, you know, so into them, and yet like they're not seeing it. And I'm like, you'd be surprised how many people feel this way. Like, you know, where you can have an abundance of signs and still be like, well, maybe this is just a friends thing. You know, like you can really psych yourself out of these moments and need multiple reminders and a consistency of character before you start to go, okay, like maybe I can start to believe this. But I think especially for someone as kind of introverted and cautious as Nilo, they need Telhan to be showing up consistently for like a long time before they can start to even begin to comprehend that. Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. And I mean, that's the power of shame though, right? So like shame is that belief that I am bad, and Nilo has that negative belief of like, I'm worthless or I'm not good enough or I have to do all the things or wear a mask. That's the power of shame.
And wanting that too, like wanting to be in the shadows and in the periphery and not wanting to be in the center of the room and under people's scrutiny and, you know, and growing up with such a critical parent who just, you know, nothing they ever do will be good enough for them. And like, you know, having coming from me myself, having a parent who, you know, was an alcoholic and, you know, like, I think you can probably feel that there's a lot of real, like, heart to the character and their relationship with their mother. I think there's a scene, I won't give away anything, but there's a moment of catharsis for them that I really wanted them to have, where they finally kind of say all the things that they've just like never truly believed until that moment about themselves. And the fact that they are worthy. And that was really important for me. And I think I've had a lot of people message me who've had difficult relationships with their parents, saying how much that scene meant to them. Yeah.
That is incredible. You know, and I really do believe in the power of story and how it can be so therapeutic, you know, and there's actually a type of trauma therapy. I cannot talk, sorry. Of it. I mean, it's essentially writing out your narrative, your story. And
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, like, I'm sure I put a little bit of myself in all of my characters, and a lot of it's empathy too, but I think, you know, it's so cool when I have readers say like, I gave this book to my mom, or I like gave this book to like, my, you know, spouse or like different people. And they're like, this is how I'm feeling about this thing. And sometimes removing yourself from the story and having it be this like epic tale of like monsters and magic and things like that almost feels more honest than like actually telling it from your own perspective in some ways. Like, and it's really cool when people have said, like, I gave this book to my mom and I think she understands like my gender identity now, or like, you know, understands where I'm coming from about this thing. And, like, honestly, I save all of those comments. I have like a journal where I write them all down.
Wow. That's really powerful.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, as a storyteller, you have quite the voice, you know, and quite the platform. And I feel like you've really utilized that. But it also sounds like what you were saying is very authentic and honest and genuine, that you're drawing from some personal experiences as well of like having a parent with an addiction and how that probably influenced and impacted you. And I can imagine really helped with empathy for Nilo's character. And like you said, like certain characters you drew probably like
definitely. I put like a little seed in all of them. Like so much of each character is not me. Like I have a much more extroverted personality than Nilo does. you know, like, or I'm not like a swashbuckling warrior, like a lot of these characters, but you know, the feelings of like feeling like you're an outsider and wanting to belong, I think are universal feelings to all of us. And, you know, having come from a primatology background, it's not even just a human experience, you know, it's like there's these like biological desires to feel seen and understood. And, you know, that like kind of transcend humanity even. And then there's like little personal moments that I put into characters like Karis's story in the Amethyst Kingdom, the last book. She goes through a whole mental health journey in that book. And it's, you know, it's in fantasy. So it's not, she's not diagnosed, but I try and describe that she has PMDD in the book, which is something that I also have. And like that journey of going through depressive cycles and like feeling like the book starts off, this isn't a spoiler, this is like the first scene, the book starts off with basically her getting dropped off in this new court where she's trying to win the crown, and all of her friends and support systems go back to their own lives. Mm-hmm. And so all of a sudden she's kind of like, you know, like a puppet with its strings cut in a way, where all of the things that were keeping her kind of aloft and going disappear, and how she totally had convinced herself that she was doing fine. And how quickly when those support systems disappear, she drops back into this kind of dark place. And how she's struggling with accepting the fact that like, no matter how far forward she goes, this struggle is only one step beside her, you know, it kind of always is like, it's never, she can never leave it so far behind. It's always like within grasp, and it, and the smallest things can kind of trigger her back into it. And I think that for a lot of people, it was cathartic to read that, because I think a lot of people have to feel like they have to justify why they're having like depressive episodes or dark times in their life, and that their life isn't that bad, and they should, you know, like they have all the good things and they shouldn't feel that way because of X, Y, and Z. And I really wanted to like have that conversation with people that like, you know, there's no, you can be a royalty with all the money in the world and still be just as susceptible to these things. So, and also I think that it's nice to have more menstruation and fantasy as well. So
yeah, I was going to say, I feel like there are a couple authors who have included that, but PMDD, I don't think I've read about that in the romantasy genre, which is super powerful that you included that too.
Yeah. It's been really cool having people be like, oh my gosh, this is me, you know, like, and feeling really seen in her character, and, you know, not making it taboo or something that should be quiet, but making it kind of front and center. Like, yes, there's epic battles and monsters and magic and things like that, but there's also just this character who's just trying to like keep it together and is kind of sad and lonely and touch starved and just needs a connection with someone. And then her ex shows up and it's like, okay, well, what am I going to do about this?
Yeah, I'm really interested to see how that goes. Yeah. I'm really excited to look.
I hope you enjoy it.
Yeah. And that makes sense that her people kind of have gone back to their own courts. I mean, cause really like all of the books up until this point, I feel like people find their place, so to speak. Yeah. Right. And
she's kind of the third wheel. And what that does to a person when all of your friends start pairing off and you're feeling like you're kind of left behind and you're so happy for them, but you like don't know how to kind of. And so she thinks, you know, winning this crown is going to do that for her. It's going to fulfill all of the things that she's missing. And then very quickly has a reckoning that that might not be the case.
Yeah, that sounds very powerful. And I was going to say, AK, earlier you were talking about that neurobiological wiring that we all have for belonging, which is so true. And I do think that piece of like found family, or I don't know, you know, that is the trope, but you definitely see that throughout the series of like connections being formed and vulnerability, like what we were saying earlier, and people having the courage to share more of themselves. And I will say, this is the last therapy, well, maybe probably not, but like Brene Brown, I don't know if you're familiar with Brene Brown, but she's and I might butcher this for people who really are like in love with her. I love her. She's wonderful, but I don't know all of her stuff. But she does talk about like as building relationships, you need to have consistency in relationship and reliability and vulnerability for people to feel safe. And so kind of going back to what you were saying with Nilo, like tell him, like just continue to show up, you know? And it was that consistency and that reliability that like helped, I feel like probably Nilo feel that trust and that sense of safety. But anyway, I was just going to say that neurobiological wiring for connection is so, I definitely see the connections.
Yeah. And I think that's a big thing in Rua's story too, you know, like you have these two sisters who were raised very differently. One with like a very like solid attachment to a caregiver and like a family, and one without it, and what that kind of does to a person, and how the whole kind of crew of the story, the found family of the story, keeps kind of just being there and showing up for her. And, you know, that sense of like, I've got you, like, we're like, whatever you need, I'm going to be there. And eventually she realizes like that they actually mean it and they're not weaponizing it. And, but like it, that takes her so long. And I think it does take a lot of us a long time. It's funny when sometimes it's interesting, the people who really don't like Rua's character in The Witch's Blade quite often use the same sort of language that like autistic people hear all the time of like, her life isn't that hard. She should just try harder. She wasn't being nice enough. She should have just like, you know, these things. And I'm like, this is, it's really interesting that those are the things that they're picking up on, because like it was very intentional. And I think that for a lot of us, I think it's probably the realest thing about her is that she sets these intentions to try harder and do better and then immediately fails, like, you know, and has to start again. Like, no, I'm going to let people in. I'm going to try. I'm going to like try and be kinder to my family and all of these things. And then immediately the first opportunity to prove that just doesn't do it.
Yeah. Thought her story was really beautiful. I mean, all of the characters and their stories are beautiful in different ways, but I loved Rua. I was here for her. I mean, gosh, underneath it all, I mean, her tender heart, you know, and like her spirit. And I just wanted to like, give her a big hug, even though she would have hated that, you know, like, can I just give you, I feel like I really like Remy is sort of like my personality. And so like I would have probably tried to like love on Rua too much, and then Rua would be like, bitch, what's she doing? But and I'd be like, no, but really I love you.
Remy's just like so excited. Like I have family and I want to be connected and like I want this relationship like I have with my kind of like adopted brother, and I want this all of this stuff, and then is like kind of rejected, and you know, is like, I don't know how to, I thought we'd have this reconciliation and it would be beautiful, and instead it's this rocky kind of tumultuous thing. And but Rue was trying her best. She just like, she never had any example of how to like have good relationships, you know.
So yeah, like some major attachment trauma. I mean, come on, they all do, but like, I mean, for real, they all do. Yes. But then Remy's like, I think there's a one point in The Witch's Blade where I feel like something along the lines of like that Remy doesn't understand like her history, obviously, like her background, her story with the witches, and because Remy was coming from a completely different perspective, right? And like had that amazing brown witch that like loved on her and nurtured her, right? Yeah. And had her back.
Yeah, it's exactly that, where she's like, aren't witches great? They took care of us, they raised us, they like, you know, but she doesn't realize that it's just was totally different, that she was kind of not treated like family and very othered, and like just kind of kept alive because they needed her, you know, and like this kind of cold stoicism that she has been taught to her by them, you know. Yes. So Yeah. And, but then you have like someone as damaged as Renwick, who's able to like, you know, she doesn't feel like she's the broken one with him, you know, like they both are super broken and they both kind of need each other to pull each other out of it. So I think like they ended up being quite a good pairing in that he could handle her, you know, like, and she can handle him. And, and they both kind of needed to learn lessons from each other in a way that like nobody else would have been strong enough to handle. So, yeah.
Yeah. So how do you keep these characters straight, I guess, like their arcs? Do you have a place that you write it all down?
No, It was in the process of writing the High Mountain Court that I realized who everybody was going to end up with, you know, and even like there's a scene in the High Mountain Court where Karis is talking about Ursin and people are like, why is this in here? You know, what is going on? Like, why are we already talking about this? And I'm like, it'll all make sense in the, you know, I knew I wanted to kind of plant these seeds of all these characters from the very beginning. And so because they all have very like distinctive personalities, they're very like different energy wise that it was very easy to like keep them all straight. But I, you know, sometimes in the books when they're side characters, they're more just like the kind of the comic relief or like the like fun moment. And then when you get to their stories, you realize that they're just so much more than just this kind of like, you know, joke quip, one liner person. So, yeah.
I definitely felt that way with Bree and Talhin.
Yeah. Cause wow. They're the kind of jokesters of the group, but then they get to their own romances and you realize that they have their own damage and things they need to unlearn about themselves. And yeah.
Yeah, they to absolutely have their own trauma narratives.
Yeah.
So I guess because these characters are so different, you're able to have a different set of like goals and intentions for each of them.
Definitely. Yeah. And they kind of need different people in their lives to hold a mirror up to them, you know, like, because not everybody needs the same thing.
In terms of friendship, too, with Rua and Anarin, is that how you say her name?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I feel like there's some of that mirroring happening there, too, you know, mm-hmm. of like, I don't know, I feel like that was a really beautiful, like, restorative relationship where she becomes besties with another witch, but like, this witch, you know, has her own trauma, mm-hmm. too, Anarin does.
Yeah.
I don't know. That pairing
and they both kind of grew up beautiful. Not really like Rua grew up being a fae amongst witches and Anarin grew up being a witch amongst fae, and so both of them were never truly like accepted, and I think that, you know, that's definitely something for me, like I've lived in a lot of different countries but I still sound American, you know, and so there's no amount of time that I will be anywhere in the world where I will sound like I belong there, you know, like I will always be kind of like a foreigner wherever I am in the world. Even when I go back to like my hometown, people are like, where are you from? Because I don't sound like the people there anymore. And I've always been really interested in so many of my friends are people who lived half their lives in different countries and kind of don't really, you couldn't really drop them anywhere and have them sound and act like they fit in wherever they are in the world. And I think both Rua and Anarin are characters like that, where, you know, you couldn't put them with a bunch of fae and they'd fit in. You couldn't put them with a bunch of witches and they'd fit in. Like, no matter where they are, they kind of stick out as something else. And so in that unique way, they kind of see each other and get each other. Yeah.
Which is interesting because I don't want to give anything away, but other characters have that too, where it's mm-hmm. like some characters were born in a different court and then no longer lived in that court. And then we're like, oh, I want to become a leader in a different
It's like, I look like I'm from here, I sound like I'm from here, I like, and I wanted to have a lot of characters that were these kind of transient characters who you really couldn't pin down to any one place, because I think a lot of times, especially in fantasy and in world building, it's kind of like, well, these people are from here and these people are from here and they all stay there forever and never, like, you know. But if you look at, like, you know, you have people who have, like, you know, American accents, but they're living in Italy, and that you have people who have British accents, but they're living in Australia. And, like, you know, it's just, it's not like that. And it wouldn't be like that even in a fantasy world. So I really wanted to have these characters who kind of felt like rudderless, like they just didn't have any place in the world, and then them deciding that they had to make it for themselves.
And I think, again, there's that sense of another theme of belonging too, and like finding their people and found family, and even like finding their place in the world geographically, you know, of sense of belonging. I was going to ask you more about, like, your, because earlier in the conversation, I was like, so you're American. So this kind of, I feel like I'm feeding into some of that too. And that sense of like belonging for you of like, where do you feel like you belong? I mean, and you identified yourself as Kiwi.
Yeah. Even now living in Australia, I still feel very like a Kiwi living in Australia. And in that, I mean, most of my adult life really has been spent in New Zealand. I'm still more up to date with like New Zealand politics and what's going on in New Zealand than I am Australia even. And there's so many Kiwis who live here in Queensland. Like there's just a huge population of Kiwis. So I definitely feel like, you know, that's a huge part of my identity, but I, you know, I would never like be able to be like, oh, I was born in New Zealand. Like you can hear I wasn't born in New Zealand, you know? So I think I will always be a little bit of an outsider to wherever I am, you know, like even when I haven't been back to the States in a really long time, but like when I do go back, people are like, you know, just some of the words I say and the phrasing I use, like I'm usually pretty good when I'm talking to Americans that I say most of the right words, but like in my day-to-day life I don't, you know, because like my kids have different accents to me and like, you know, so it is
so weird. No, is it not that? It's got to be weird.
Yeah, it is. It's a bit strange where you just kind of feel like a bit like an alien wherever you are, you know, but also in a way it's kind of beautiful because you're able to see beyond just this, like, you know, so like where I grew up, we had such like a limited view of the world. And I think a lot of people who grow up in the U.S. have a very like U.S. centric view of the entire world. And then when you live other places, you start to go like, oh, wow, okay. Like, and you start to have this more global view. Oh, I love living in other countries and kind of going off the beaten path of, you know, the tourist destinations and just kind of like living in these small areas where, you know, people, like, I think that's when you really realize the commonalities we all share, like universally, you know, the things that we want in life. And so, I think that that's where like a lot of like the humanity of my stories comes from too, is that on some deep level, we all want like the same things, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And earlier when you were talking about these characters and their transient stories, and I love in stories where characters are also just like traveling from one place to another. I love that. And I think maybe because one of my values is travel and seeing the world, maybe that's part of it. But I love that so much. And there's quite a bit of travel that happens. And it's like getting to see different parts of the world anyway. And then what you were saying earlier of, you know, being able to dive into the culture of these different places and.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely, especially the High Mountain Court, wanted it to be like a questing book because it's kind of like you're getting a little bit of a tour of the world so that in the subsequent books, you kind of know where you are. The other books, like characters move from place to place, but not quite as much as the first book. So the first book's kind of like, and here's, you know, the Southern Court, and here's, you know, like here we are over here.
Love travel. I really do.
Yeah, I love the, like, just, like, camping and, like, being sleeping out under the stars and, like, you know, how well you sleep after a day of travel, you know?
You know, that's so interesting. I think randomly yesterday I was thinking about that. I'm like, gosh, these characters in the romantasy genre, you know, it's like they can be up all night or whatever. I'm like, how are they feeling, like, emotionally, psychologically? If I don't get, and my husband always makes fun of me for this, not really makes fun of me, but I need like 8 hours at least of sleep. Mm-hmm. And especially having a toddler, that is not fucking happening. But anyway, yeah. So.
I hear you.
Like, trying to put myself in their shoes, I'm like, man, I would be feeling pretty terrible. I don't think I would survive. I mean, they've got all of these, like, tests that they're on. I mean, there's so much adventure happening. And
I mean, I think also, like, a lot of them, this is, like, their partying years. Like, a lot of them are in their early 20s. And so they're, you know, like, they're, like, pre-kids. And all of that energy is going to, like, questing and battles and stuff. You know, also, like, all of the fae are magically, like, stronger and can heal themselves and things. So I'm sure that that helps. Like, I would love to have some of those powers when I was, like, up all night feeding baby monkeys and, like, baby macaws and stuff. You know, that would have been great.
Mm-hmm. Yep. No, I think that's probably some of the allure too of like the romanticy genre, fantasy genre of like learning more about these different, you know, witches and fae and what makes it like magical, you know, and otherworldly, where we can really immerse ourselves in these different worlds, you know, and yeah I think it's so interesting.
I love getting lost in other worlds and other books. Like, reality isn't that much fun. Like, you know, like, especially like, just, you know, I mean, in the last few years and things, but like, I think that all of us seek some forms of escapism and wanting to like, just have the pressure off of having to feel like we're trying to navigate the real world, even in contemporary fiction. Like in fantasy, it really is, you're just in this completely other place and you can kind of get lost in it. And even in historical romance, like Bridgerton and things like that, you're just kind of like getting lost in this other world for a little while. And there's something really beautiful about that and restful, I think, you know, for our brains that are constantly like going and anxious and worrying about what's going on in the actual world. It's kind of nice to get this little time out to go somewhere else for a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Are you reading anything good right now? Or what are you reading?
I'm just about finished with When the Moon Hatched by Sarah A. Parker. Mm-hmm. It's such a gorgeous book. Talk about world building.
Yes.
Yeah.
For real.
Gorgeous, gorgeous story. Yeah. So yeah, I love books like that where you can really just like get lost in a different world for a bit.
Yeah. I definitely felt that way reading that book too. I love that book. Yeah. My favorites,
but even in contemporary romance, it does feel like it's not, especially like rom-coms. Like I love a good rom-com between fantasy books because, like I love fantasy, but it's so heavy. And then you know, and you really need to pay attention, you know. And then rom-coms is just like light and funny. You can jump in and jump out, and you don't have to like pay too close attention. And it still feels like you're in a completely other world where everything's going to be okay, you know. Like, yeah.
I was going to ask you. So, what is that like switching between genres then as a writer? You know, because Sarah Parker, right? For instance, you just brought her up, right? She like also wrote To Bleed a Crystal Bloom. I don't know if you've read that series yet. But they're both like very fantasy, very world building. I would think that, I don't know, like switching it might be difficult, you know? I don't know.
Yeah, I think for me, it's like the, you know, in the same way that actors kind of get into character with like certain lines or certain songs or, you know, certain phrasing, like it's the same for me with fantasy and rom-coms, where it's just that and energetically they're so different that it's very easy to just switch into the tone of one or the other. But I usually write one at a time. Like I'll be kind of ideating and thinking about one thing while I'm working on another, but I You know, so I'm writing a rom-com right now. So I'm thinking about a fantasy book that I'm going to start. But I mean, you know, the beauty of ADHD, I've got like 8 different timelines going all the time. But I think my rom-coms are very like, they're very much written for like neurodivergent people. They sound very ADHD. All of the characters have these very like ranty stream of consciousness sort of inner monologues. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, very different than like the kind of more beautiful, sweeping fantasy language for mm-hmm. sure. Yeah.
I do like a good rom-com. I don't know. It's just something about fantasy and romantic. I'm in it. I'm in it to win it right now. I like can't.
Yeah, totally. I mean, there was a long time where it was the only thing I was reading and writing. But then eventually I used to write like novellas between my novels. And now I write rom-coms between my novels. So it's just kind of like a palate cleanser. They're shorter. I write them faster in between the fantasy. And then By the time I'm done with a fantasy, I'm so ready to just like write a fun little rom-com. And then by the time I'm done with a rom-com, I'm like so ready to get back into like the epic world building again. So it's kind of nice having that.
Yes. Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And you probably, I mean, could you share a little bit about like future fantasy or any ideas that you have for future fantasy novels?
Well, so I've just finished the last book in the Golden Court trilogy. So A River of Golden Bones is the first book. Mm-hmm. And the second book, A Sky of Emerald Stars, comes out on Christmas Eve. And then the third book, the third and final book, will be coming out next year. And so I've just finished that book. And now I'm doing my rom-com. and then I'm going to start a brand new series for fantasy. Right now, I think, you know, I have 2 different series that I'm working on. One is all sapphic and one is Why Choose. And so we'll see which one I decide to put out first into the world. But I've been having a lot of fun with both of them.
That's awesome. That's so cool. Yeah. I saw the cover reveal for the book that's coming out. Can you repeat the title?
Yeah, it's called A Sky of Emerald Stars.
Yeah. That book looks beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those covers are gorgeous, aren't they? I'm so obsessed with them. And each one is like kind of based off of a different pride flag too. So you have like the first one's the gender fluid flag. The second one is the gender queer flag. And the third one's going to be the lesbian flag. And so kind of based on the characters of the story. So, and I love all the colors in it as well. So, that series is, has been really fun to write as well. Totally different world, but like same kind of epic love stories and action. Yes. Yeah.
Absolutely. Can you share a little bit more about what that was like? I don't know, writing and creating those worlds and maybe some of your goals and intentions about creating like a safe place for folks.
Yeah, I mean, like, I have a very distinct memory of, you know, it was probably, 15 years ago now, but of sitting around in a cafe with all of my fantasy nerd friends who loved, like, you know, Tolkien and loved all of, like, the new kind of romantasy books that were coming out. But we just, none of us could see ourselves as the main characters of the stories. And, you know, how we had to really kind of put our imagination goggles on to kind of put ourselves in the characters. And I kind of decided then and there, like, you know, if ever I write any books, like, you're all coming with me. Like, you're all going to be the main characters of these books.
And you say it's so accessible and representation is so present there for these books, for people. Yeah.
Yeah, because I wanted everyone to, like, I wanted more people to feel kind of, like, welcome into the world of fantasy romance, and also that they didn't just have to suffice on side characters, that they could be the main characters, that they could see themselves as the heroes of these stories. And I know how important that is to me and how impactful it is to me when I can see myself represented in storytelling, and so I wanted to make sure that I was doing that with the stories that I was writing as well. And I feel like So much of my writing, even though it's set in another world, is very, very much a commentary on like what's happening in the actual world as well. And so I wanted to create spaces for queer characters, for neurodivergent characters, for characters of all different sizes. You know, like it was important to me that more people were able to kind of like escape into the world of fantasy and be able to like see themselves without having to try so hard to imagine themselves as like, you know, a skinny blonde straight,
right.
You know, character. So yeah. And there, I do think some books, I do almost feel like this isn't really meant for me, you know, like this isn't really my, yeah. like meant for someone who looks like me, you know, and I think that when you can kind of like see yourselves in these stories in the same way you see like with so many TV shows and movies now, just how excited people are for these stories because they can see themselves in them and what that means to them, you know, it's just, it's so huge and it can't be undervalued. Like, and so for me thinking like, you know, I have this platform and I have this opportunity to tell stories, like I'm not going to water it down so that fewer people are included in these worlds. And I don't want to tell stories where even I can't see myself in, you know, like, so, yeah, I mean, like, would my books possibly be much more popular if I had, you know, like, cis, straight, you know, skinny, neurotypical people? Probably, possibly. But it's, you know, what joy would that bring me? You know, like, like, what's the point then? Why, like, for me, it's the act of telling these stories and including people in these worlds that is the greatest joy of it, you know? So, you know, the success inclusion would feel hollow without that. Yeah.
I feel like inclusion, it seems like that's a value of yours, you know,
for sure. And
getting to the heart of like these characters. And
so, like, you know, we've sold hundreds of thousands of books at this point, and that's just so beyond my comprehension. Like, the High Mountain Court series is in 11 languages, and, you yeah. know, like, I just...
I'm meeting with an internationally, like, best-selling author. I'm like, this is insane.
It does feel really surreal, and then every once in a while, I'll just kind of get... knocked with it, you know, because I'm so, I have my head down in the minutia of like, what deadlines do I need to meet and things. And then every once in a while, I'll, you know, remember to kind of like lift my head up and look. And I'm like, wow, this is, you know, so beyond what I you know, my goal, my 5-year plan goal was to be able to like in 5 years make more money than my minimum wage conservation job, you know. And so to now be able to like, you know, make an international move happen based on the sales of my books and things is pretty incredible. So, wow. Yeah, it's very humbling for sure.
Wow. Yeah. I hope you can like peek up and look around and soak it all in and feel all the love for the hard work that, and sharing your gift with the world, you know, I hope that you can
soak
that in. I was going to ask like so many questions for you, AK, and I know that I could just probably keep on talking to you, but I did want to ask how has it been writing with two kiddos? And then on top of that, you know, with some of this additional special needs and accommodation, like how has that been for you?
Yeah.
Being able to find space and time for that.
It's definitely been a challenge, but also, you know, it's been beautiful in a way because I have prove to myself that I can do it, you know, and that it can be done. When I was first starting out, I would wake up at like 4 a.m. and just write for 2 hours from 4 to 6 at my kitchen table. Didn't have an office, didn't have a desk, you know. It was the only time I had before my kids woke up. And once they were awake, they needed me radically the entire time they were awake and didn't sleep very much. So that was the only time I had. And I realized than how much I wanted this and how much of a lifeline it was to me when I was willing to, I'm not a morning person, but I was willing to just wake up and however many words I could get in, I'd get in those mornings and sitting in the dark of my kitchen with my coffee. And, you know, wow. Once the book started coming out and we started having some money coming in, you know, if I had had a day job, I probably would have quit that day job to write full time. But because my day job was caring for these two gorgeous kids, like, I was like, well, there's never going to be, you can't quit your day job. there's no stopping this roller coaster, you know? But I did start to be able to carve out like a little more time as they got bigger to have some days of the week that, you know, I could take a few hours to myself and, write during the day. Didn't have to wake up so early, you know, got a desk, started investing a little more in the business. I'm very lucky because my partner, works from home as well. So he works doing, computer programming and works in special effects for movies and things. What a guy.
You know, doing, but I don't know.
Yeah, like, we're definitely connected through like Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit films and stuff like that. You know, it's like, it's such, you know, Tolkien was one of the reasons I wanted to write fantasy. And, you know, he worked on those films. And now I have the same publisher as the Tolkiens. And, you know, it's just like, it's just so crazy. Yeah.
That is wild.
Yeah.
That's incredible. Wow.
Yeah. All happened, you know. I remember being in like calculus in high school and making up fake languages in the margins of my paper. And my math teacher was like, when are you ever going to use this? Like, this is not worth your time. You should be learning calculus, you know. And I should probably like send him a letter or something.
Like, I'm actually an internationally best-selling author. That's where
I silly little languages paid off in the end.
That's so funny that you bring that up about the other languages, because I've always wondered how you guys come up with these words and like, I don't know, these court names. I don't, whatever. Yeah, no, it's so fascinating to me.
I studied Latin in university and classics, so I had to do a lot of like conjugating vowels and verb endings and things. And then I lived in a bunch of countries that spoke other languages, and attempted my best to learn all of them. And I'm semi fluent in Spanish, so. But like, you know, in the different regions I lived in, they spoke Spanish differently, and like the different dialects and things like that. And so, in my fantasy worlds of the different languages, I wanted them to have like different mouth sounds to them, so that like if you could hear it without reading the words, you would know like these like double A's and this SH and these certain sounds, like are they more flowing, are they more guttural, like you would be able to sense like what those words were. And then in my own nerdy way, I've actually like conjugated what those words are and what they mean.
Oh my gosh, you were
brilliant. And nobody else will ever care or know. But, cool. You know, like you see these same repetition of words and sentences that mean similar things and stuff. But I just wanted them to feel like you'd be like, yeah, that makes sense that that's, that sentence is in this, in a witch language and not a fae language or whatever. Yeah.
I was about to ask you, the Mimbic, is that how you say
it? Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the witch language, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Is that language type more closely to, I don't know, any other
language? It almost sound a little bit more like Slavic, German, a little sharper, like witches are more serious. They like mean business. They don't have time for like the flowery nonsense that the fae speak, you know. So I wanted it to sound like a little bit more like they use fewer words to get to their point, you know. Like I wanted the language to feel like what their kind of values were. Yeah.
If you were a character in one of your books, who would you be?
Oh, that is hard. I mean, I feel like I'm a combination of all of them a little bit. I wish I could be as brave as some of them. I feel like I'm probably the closest to Nilo in that I'd rather be hiding in the library, reading a good book and using diplomacy instead of like sword fighting. Like, I don't want to be like getting into battles with people. But yeah, I think like probably a combination of like Nilo and a little bit of Remy is probably the two. Yeah.
Wow. This has been so much fun. Like,
yes, it's been lovely chatting really with you.
This.
It's great getting into more of the like mental health of the characters too. Like, you can tell with your like knowledge and background, like it's really nice being able to like chat about some of those things, because some people just want to chat about like the higher level stuff of the books, but it's fun diving, kind of dissecting the characters a little too.
I as a reader, that's what I do. Like, I love dissecting, and I can see that that would probably be something that you enjoy doing based on the books that you've written. So I'm really here for those. I'm a sucker for a really good like character arc and character development and getting to the heart of who the character is. And I love that so much. It speaks to my soul. But
yeah, same. And everything I like watch and read and listen to, I'm always like, it's just so satisfying. So I try to create that where I can. But yeah, I'm the same as a reader too. I love dissecting characters. Yeah.
But and I wanted to say too, so AK, just as a plug for you too, like all of your books, obviously people can find them. Earlier in the conversation, you were saying, you know, even I think that that's a great idea, like going to your local bookstore if they don't have your books for whatever reason and being like, hey, let's order these guys.
Your library, wherever you read.
Yes. And then your books are on Kindle Unlimited.
Yes.
Right.
So High Mountain Court, the first four books in that series are in KU.
Okay. KU.
And I think the fifth one might eventually be. I'm not sure. That's not my that's the publisher's choice. Whether it goes in or out of Kindle Unlimited. And then the Golden Court series isn't. But that does mean like it's everywhere. So you can read it in all sorts of places. And you can also request the eBooks from like your library or, you know, listen to the audiobooks. The audiobooks of the Golden Court series is pretty epic. I don't know if have you seen Our Flag Means Death?
That's so funny that you bring that up. My husband and I got we got so into that series and we're sad.
Okay. So you'll appreciate this then. So you know the character Jim?
Yes.
Jim. So the actor who plays Jim, Vico Ortiz, is the narrator of my Golden Court series. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. I'm going to have to share that with him.
I freaked out when I found out that they might narrate the series. I was like so, so, so excited because I absolutely love them. So,
oh my gosh, that show is so good.
Is the narrator of A River of Golden Bones, and they do like just such a phenomenal job, like really elevate the whole story. So I highly recommend the audiobook.
Incredible. I was going to say too, I started listening to the audiobooks for the Five Crowns of Okrith. And I was wondering, do you like have auditions or something for these?
Yeah, well, usually you get like a few different options of people. And so I picked Mella Lee, who's the narrator of the Five Crowns series. And she does just such a phenomenal job because it is such a kind of non-Eurocentric book, and having so many different accents and like kind of languages and different sounding people, like the way that she manages all of those characters so brilliantly is just awesome.
Yeah, she did such a good job. Yeah.
I really like made it difficult for her being like, they all have different accents, you know, whereas the River of Golden Bones is more kind of like everybody has roughly American accents, but just like slightly different. So it's not as complicated.
Well, AK, it was such a joy talking with you, and I hope
so you're lovely good talking with you too.
And I can't wait for again for the second book to come out Christmas Eve. And
oh, well, thank you so much for having me. It was so lovely chatting with you.
Well, thanks. It was really fun.
Hey guys, thank you so much for listening to my fourth episode on the Romanticy Library. It was a true honor to talk with A.K. Mulford, internationally best-selling author of the Five Crowns of Okra series, novellas, the Golden Court series, and quirky rom-coms. I love talking with them about the writing process, our mutual love for their characters, neurodiversity, and writing an inclusive series for all readers, as well as their compelling journey of becoming an author. Their story is fascinating. It was so much fun talking with them, and I could have kept on talking to them. AK's website is www.akmulford.com, and you can purchase their books on their website, Amazon, or any major book retailer. Also, feel free to request their books at your local bookstore or library. If you go to your local bookstore, they can order AK's books for you, which will help their books get on more shelves, which is a win-win. I really hope that you enjoyed this conversation. There will be many more episodes to come with amazing authors, as well as deep dives into various writing processes, general life conversations, spicy spice, mental health discussions, favorite tropes, and many more tangents. Feeling generous, please feel free to leave a 5-star rating and review. Thanks for being here and for helping to celebrate these amazing authors. I'm loving talking with these authors who write fanciful stories that make my heart sing. Thank you guys so much. See you next week.